This episode is brought to you by The Jordan Harbinger Show. Want a new podcast to look forward to each week? One that's entertaining, informative, and packed with actionable content? You know you do. And that is The Jordan Harbinger Show, a top-notch podcast named Best of Apple in 2018, and has only gotten better. Jordan goes deep with fascinating people, from authors and scientists to mobsters, spies, and hostage negotiators. During his discussions, Jordan pulls out tactical bits of wisdom for you to use to become a more informed, critical thinker. You'll learn and have a good time. He's very easy to listen to. My two recent favorites are Episode 972, Mustafa Suleiman, The Coming Wave of Artificial Intelligence, and Episode 843, Ellie Honig, How the Rich Get Away with Crime. You can't go wrong adding The Jordan Harbinger Show to your rotation. It's incredibly interesting. There's never a dull show. Search for The Jordan Harbinger Show, that's H-A-R-B as in boy, I-N as in Nancy, G-E-R, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
You know, some people enjoy composing their own music, chord by chord, and others are happiest when they come across that one perfect song. Work is not a lot different than that. Whether you prefer building your own workflow or using a pre-made template, with Monday.com, you and the team can work in a way that's comfortable for everyone. Tap the banner to go to Monday.com and build your own amazing workflow or find an awesome template. No judgment.
Hello, and thank you for listening to The History of World War II podcast, episode 467, interview with Damian Lewis about his book, Churchill's Secret Warriors, the explosive true story of the Special Forces Desperados of World War II. And, of course, the recently released movie based on it. The British have been suffering defeat after defeat, but worst of all, U.S. supplies that are keeping the island nation fed are being sunk by Hitler's U-boats. Finally, a chink in the Nazi armor has been found, and Churchill, the very definition of thinking outside the box, comes up with a clever plan. Of course, if whoever goes on this mission is caught, it will mean certain death for them, as London will claim no responsibility. Mr. Lewis, thank you for coming on the show yet again.
Yeah, no, great to be back with you. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. I appreciate that so much. I think this is your second or third time on the show, so you win. Anyway, I've seen the movie, loved it. I saw it twice. And if I could, let me just give a couple of impressions, the first impressions of the movie. One, this was definitely a Guy Ritchie film. There was a lot of action. There's moments of humor, moments of suspense. In fact, they looked like they were having almost too good of a time at times, and I almost wanted to be there. Almost. The next, and I'm sure you've heard this before, is Miss Gonzalez came this close, and my fingers are almost touching, to stealing this movie away from everybody. She had such a presence on the film. It was so amazing. And the last thing I learned was never let Henry Cavill near your best cigars or drinks cabinet. I absolutely love that scene when he's taking things he should not be taking.
Yeah, it's absolutely fabulous. Yeah, you've done. That's a very good summation, and you're right. Miss Gonzalez really is a show stealer, and she does that very much in the movie. Couldn't agree with you.
She's pretty and all this stuff, but just her presence, it was really amazing. So I guess my first question is, why haven't we actually heard much or anything at all, I guess, about Operation Postmaster before? Because it is a great story.
Yeah, no, you're right. Just going back to Gonzalez just for a second.
Yes, please.
When I was at the premiere, there was in New York, there was an after premiere party, and right. I went up to her and I gave her a coin. So a coin from the Special Forces Club in London, the club that was formed in World War II for people who were in the Special Operations Executive, the Ministry for Ungentlemanly Warfare, and related units. And I gave her a coin, to say, look, with appreciation for your performance in the movie. And she was very touched. And she said, I studied really really in depth what these brave women were like, these women who went into, you know, deep behind enemy lines, yeah. you know, with nothing but their nerve and their audacity to protect them. She said, you know, I really felt this role, you know, in my heart, and I'm so glad that I managed to bring it alive on the screen. And I felt that was really, you know, really genuine of her. So, you know, I commend her for her performance. And on to the question of why Postmaster is a little known operation. It's largely due to secrecy.
Ah.
So Postmaster was one of the most, if not the most, sensitive and risk-laden operations carried out by the Allies in the war, covert operations. Mm-hmm. The reason being that it was a raid on the harbour of a neutral nation, Spain.
Right.
And Spain already had fascist leanings, as we all know. So, you know, Nazi Germany had intervened in the Spanish Civil War on the side of the fascists. So, you know, the relations are already close between Madrid and Berlin. So anything that might provoke Spain joining the Nazis in the war had to be avoided. And this operation, of any, was the most provocative you could imagine, because it was a raid in right. a harbour which was Spanish territory, so a neutral harbour. So it's breaking all the rules of war. So obviously, if it was found out to be a British raid, then Spain would have been provoked into joining the war. We've had no option, and that would have closed the Mediterranean to British ships and Allied shipping, and it would have been disastrous. So because the stakes were so high and the illegality of the operation was so glaring, right. the levels of secrecy involved were draconian. Yeah. And so even after the war, long after the war, when individuals who were on the mission wanted to write about it or talk about it, they still couldn't do so. And the files on Operation Postmaster were only released, you know, not that long before I wrote the book. So, you know, we're talking 10, 15 years ago. So one could not have told the story before having that material.
Right. Yeah, the British are quite known for keeping their World War II secrets, and just as you explained, for very good reasons. The last thing the British needed was the Axis to have another partner. And yeah, to lose the Mediterranean that's tantamount to almost defeat, if you will. So let's back up a bit, and you touched on something just a second ago. So again, when it comes to war, obviously the breakdown of dialogue, the breakdown of negotiations, you know, there's very few things off the table, but you're absolutely right. So where does special operations fit in that? Because you've touched on it already, but I'm just trying to think, okay, we're going to take the fight to the enemy, if we can kind of push aside the neutral territory aspect for a second. We're going to take to the fight to the enemy, but we're going to do things that normally aren't done before. I'm guessing that's why it was so risky, because it could upset the acceptable forms of warfare?
Yeah, I mean, Spain was only neutral in theory. I mean, Spain, right. Spain was overrun with Gestapo agents and you know, Nazi spies. So everybody knew on the Allied side who Spain's leaning were towards. So it was only neutral nominally.
Mm.
And in terms of changing the rules of warfare, you're absolutely right. So at the outbreak of war, or rather when, you know, France and most of Western Europe fell so catastrophically to the German blitzkrieg in a matter of weeks. And in mm-hmm. that shock and awe after that moment, you know, Winston Churchill, the British wartime leader, rightly decreed that we needed a new form of war fighting, you know, total war. So war waged, no holds barred, nothing is off the table.
Right.
That's why he formed the Ministry for Ungentlemanly Warfare. It was formed at that moment, so in 1940, to do all the things you are not allowed to do in war. That's exactly what its remit was. So it's set up to do assassinations, murder, bribery, corruption, money laundering, smuggling operations,
right.
raising guerrilla armies, terrorist attacks, anything that you could possibly think of SOE considered and actually carried out. And then when you start digging deep into the files, some of the operations are just mind-bogglingly off the wall.
Right.
And Postmaster was the first of such missions where SOE agents, who incidentally had a, you know, James Bond 007, well, that comes from these originals, the Postmaster
wow.
warriors and others like them, because they had 00 prefixes. So you were, for example, Gus March Phillips, the commander of the mission, was Agent W001. So, and you had a 00 prefix because it meant you literally had a license to kill. In fact, you didn't just have a license to kill. You had a license to do whatever you felt was necessary to help win the war. So it really was tearing up the rule book completely and establishing a new means of waging war, no holds barred. And it was deeply, deeply unpopular in Britain.
Yeah.
By those in the political establishment and by those in the military high command who, first of all, believed it wasn't gentlemanly, it wasn't the way that British officers were supposed to behave.
Right.
And secondly, within the political establishment, believed that if we went ahead and broke all the rules of war, well, then so would Nazi Germany, and we would reap the whirlwind. The truth was, of course, Nazi Germany had already torn up the rule book,
exactly.
And there were no rules left to bear witness to. And so Churchill was absolutely right, as was proven.
You're absolutely right. And you anticipated my next question, because I'm thinking, with all due respect, which Brit is known for thinking outside the box? And of course, that would be Churchill. But you're right. I mean, it was their darkest hour, if you will. I mean, it couldn't get much worse than that. And I'm guessing he's thinking, well, we're losing, so we have to change how the game is played. Very risky, very gutsy. And even though the upside, obviously, you know, the potential upside was great, so was the downside. And we'll get into that. So Churchill comes up with this idea. We have to do something because they're desperate. But let's back up a little bit. Why was Operation Postmaster needed? What's specifically going on there that the gentlemen have to go there?
Yeah, just on the point you raised, I mean, you summed it up very well. You know, Churchill absolutely realized that when we were suffering defeat on all fronts, mm-hmm. facing defeat on all fronts, and when many in Britain wanted to capitulate and sign a peace deal, with Nazi Germany, Churchill realized that not only did you have to fight the war in a completely different way, so via ungentlemanly, unconventional warfare,
right.
but also he realized that one or two of these operations, although they might seem like pinpricks in the greater scheme of the war,
mm-hmm.
what they gave you, because you'd get headlines in the British papers and then the headlines in the American papers, what they gave you, what they gave the British people, was the belief we had the ability to strike back. And that's what you need at your darkest hour. You need brave men and women to step forward and do the unthinkable to actually prove to the general population that you're not down and out, and you can fight, and actually you can win and overcome when that seems impossible. So that was Churchill's brilliance at that moment. And why was Postmaster worth, in Churchill's view and those others who backed him, why was it worth the incredible stakes?
Right.
You know, because it could have changed the course of the war had it gone wrong. Well, at that time, and for many months after, Britain was under a stranglehold from the Nazi U-boats. They, you know, everything had to be shipped into Britain,
mm-hmm.
and especially, you know, supplies under lend-lease from the USA, of course. And they were getting preyed upon by the U-boats horrendously. And one of the clandestine refitting centres for U-boats, so rearming and repairs, was believed to be these three enemy vessels moored in Fernando Po Harbour, so in a neutral Spanish harbour. Spanish territory in what's basically the armpit of Africa, so just off the coast of Equatorial Guinea.
Right.
And it was from there that many of the Atlantic U-boat fleets were being rearmed and repaired and resupplied. And so, you know, that was happening under the guise of neutrality in a Spanish port, and the Spanish were, you know, or the Spanish regime was friendly towards the Nazi regime. And so that's why the stakes, which were incredibly, incredibly high, were believed to be, by Churchill at least, and those who backed him, were believed to be worth it if we could carry out the operation and make it a success.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Right. But so is that one of the rules that the Nazi Germany broke that you were mentioning earlier? I mean, it seems like housing, repairing, and rearming your vessels in a neutral territory seems disingenuous. Either Spain's in the war or they're not. Or am I reading too much into that?
No, you're absolutely right. You know, I mean, that's against the rules of war. So you know, clearly hiding in a neutral harbour because you know that your enemy can't attack you. But basically attacking your enemy from that harbour, it's not cricket. You can't do that under the rules of war.
Right.
So, you know, you have to fight fire with fire. And if the enemy is going to behave in that way, you have to not just fight fire with fire. You have to go one better and be and outwit and outfight them at their own game. And that's exactly what Churchill was determined to do. And as I say, huge, huge opposition and animosity from many, many in high command. There were many attempts were made to sabotage Postmaster and make sure it didn't happen by, you know, senior naval and other commanders.
Yeah, I enjoyed that in your book very much, the because Churchill's got the battle against the Axis, but he's also, if you will, kind of, you know, got a battle within his own halls, because there are a lot of traditionalists thinking, oh, this isn't proper, this isn't how you do it. And so he had that two-front war, if you will. But, and kind of leaning on another part that I admire about the British during World War II, how did they find out about the U-boats being repaired and rearmed in this location?
Yeah, it's a great question. So we had, you know, diplomats in Fernando Po, and they were doubling as SOE agents. I mean, that's, you know, when the diplomats not double as spies, they often do.
Right.
So we had several in Fernando Po who were, you know, the attaché, whatever it might be, and actually they were there as SOE agents. So they had carried out some of the most extraordinary operations. You know, one of them had rowed across Fernando Po Harbour, claiming he was delivering mail from one part of the British, you know, diplomatic setup to another, and actually he'd stopped ostensibly to rest halfway across the harbour, leaning on the anchor chain of one of the ships, and in that way he'd managed to get his hands around it and measure how thick it was, and that's how we then worked out how much explosives was needed to use to actually blow the anchor chain.
Wow.
And in another even more extraordinary event, one of the senior Spanish figures in Fernando Po, one of the governors there, was found to have a mistress, and they managed to get photographs of him watering her with a watering can naked in his bedroom.
Right.
And they used those to blackmail him to get him to allow the British to do these overflights of the harbour to take reconnaissance photos of the ships and say that they were sightseeing flights. So going back to what I was saying earlier, SOE was empowered to do all the things you're not allowed to do during war, like what I've just described, blackmailing the Spanish governor in Fernando Po.
Wow. All I can say is clever chaps. You know, simple but brilliant. You get the information, you distill it, you pass it on to HQ. Somebody makes a decision, and suddenly we're off to the races. But before Postmaster gets underway, and I really love this part of your book, can you tell us a little bit about their training? Because they weren't just anybody. I mean, these guys were put through their paces. And of course, there's this one rather large gentleman with a strange accent going around with a bow and arrow in the Dorset Lakes. So if you can give us an idea of what they had to go through to get to, I guess, either to be qualified or to get ready for these very unpredictable missions.
Yeah, so there was a very rigorous and bespoke training program established in Dorset, which is a very leafy and green Aurora part of England.
Right.
And basically, it was the earliest kind of form of Special Air Service, SAS selection, or what, you know, the SEALs or Delta Force would be put through today. So, you know, dropped by a truck in the middle of the night, and you have to trek all the way back to your base, you know, navigating your way through the countryside, surviving off the land, that kind of thing. And one of those figures, one of the earliest recruits, he was a Danish noble, actually, born to a very, very well-to-do Danish family who'd grown up on their large estate in Denmark, didn't really enjoy school very much, but loved going hunting stags and fishing and usually using a bow and arrow or even with his bare hands.
Wow.
So this chap, Anders Lassen, who'd run away from school at the age 18, gone and become a merchant seaman, but then had come to Britain once war was declared and volunteered. Well, no one in the regular military knew what to do with this kind of like feral individual who loved going hunting with a bow and arrow. It's like, well, you know, we can't teach him drill. He doesn't like wearing a uniform. What can we do with him? And so he was presented to the SOE.
Oh.
And the SOE thought, well, maybe he's, you know, one of the, he's the right kind of material for the Maid Honour Force, as they became known.
Right.
And so Lassen and various other individuals end up at a manor house called Anderson Manor, so a grand rambling old British house in Dorset, which is one of the special operations executive special training stations. And he became renowned throughout Dorset. He basically became known as the Danish Robin Hood, or even the Dorset Robin Hood, because he'd go out on these operations at night, and often they were canoeing down the rivers and things, right. And he'd have his bow and arrow with him. And because he was blonde-haired and spoke with what sounded to most Dorset residents like a German accent, sure. He was arrested numerous times by the Home Guard for being an enemy alien, you know, launching a sabotage operation against some target in Dorset with bow and arrow. And every time, you know, Gus Marchphillips, his commanding officer, had to phone up the Home Guard from Anderson Manor and say, look, he's one of ours, bring him home.
Believe it or not. These
guys really were chosen because they were unconventional thinkers, they were misfits, and actually the other thing that united them was they all had a burning desire to fight. Anders Lassen, you know, his country, Denmark, had been invaded by Nazi Germany.
Right.
His country was occupied, his people were occupied. So he had vowed that, you know, he would do anything in this war to bring freedom to his nation.
That's incredible. I remember putting the book down and laughing so hard. Just the idea of him being arrested. No, yes, he's one of ours. Bring him, you know, that kind of conversation or whatever. Yeah. But so you've mentioned Gus Phillips. Excuse me, you mentioned Marchphillips, and you mentioned the Dane. Could you introduce us to some of the other members that's going to be a part of this team?
Yeah. So Gus Marchphillips was the commander, certainly of the Maid Honor Force, and Marchphillips was. He was a typical highborn English gentleman. I mean, before the war, he'd been basically horse racing and writing thrillers. That was his pre-war occupation.
Right.
And, you know, like many of these individuals, very few of them had a traditional military background. Mm-hmm. Gus Marchphillips didn't. Anders Lassen didn't. Gus Marchphillips' second in command, Geoffrey Appleyard, who became a absolutely standout figure in special operations throughout the war until he was sadly killed on operations. He was working as a wood sculptor before the war.
Wow.
So, you know, what brought Gus Marchphillips and Appleyard together was actually that they were part of the British Expeditionary Force sent to France and Belgium to try to repel, you know, the Nazi Blitzkrieg in 1940. And Gus Marchphillips and Appleyard had ended up in a foxhole on the Dunkirk beaches, getting strafed by German warplanes, feeling utterly defeated and utterly helpless.
Wow.
And at that moment, they had vowed to each other that they would find a way to fight back. And this was, you know, Operation Postmaster was their God-given opportunity. And then just one other individual it's worth you know, identifying, because it kind of gives the sense of what they were like and who they were. Because they were going to be sailing halfway around the world on a converted Brixham fishing trawler.
Right.
So it had been converted into a pleasure ship before the war. And then when it became an SOE vessel, they converted it into what's called a Q-ship, so a deception ship. So it had hidden cannons and mortars hidden behind the wheelhouse and other parts of the ship. So at the flick of a switch or a lever, you could drop the facade of it being just a normal a pleasure yacht and bring your weapons to bear.
Wow.
And because they were posing as a Swedish crew on a pleasure cruise.
Right.
I'll just repeat that because it's so bizarre.
There's a war
Swedish
going
crew on.
Right?
Pleasure cruise.
Right?
That was their cover.
Right.
They carried horse papers saying they were Swedish. Anders Lassen spoke Swedish.
Right.
He looked Swedish. So, you know, but they felt they needed a cabin boy to make the, you know, going on a pleasure cruise seem more kind of convincing. So they recruited a young 17-year-old called Buzz Perkins. Buzz was his nickname, because he looked young enough to pass as a cabin boy. And actually one of their friends, who was around about their age, who basically said, put him forward and said, yes, you know, take my son, because we know you need that for your deception and we need to defeat the Nazis. So Buzz, off you go.
And so
it was that kind of attitude. Can you imagine that? You know, putting your son forward to sail halfway around the world with a bunch of wild lunatics on a mission, which by anyone's reckoning was suicidal.
Yeah.
Because being serious at the moment, if these guys were captured,
right,
the very worst lay ahead, because the British government said, you will be, all SOE agents were like this, you will be disowned.
Yeah.
You are deploying in civilian dress, not in uniform, you will be completely disowned by the British government. We you know, we'll just say you're a bunch of rogues who went AWOL without any permission. And because they were in civilian dress, so therefore they'd be classed as spies, then, you know, the very worst would happen if they're captured, torture and death would follow. So, you know, by anyone's reckoning, this was a mission which beggared belief in that there were actually individuals who stepped forward as volunteers to undertake it.
That's incredible. Yeah, to hear you put it like that, it's pretty much we're going on a mission. It's either going to be successful or there's going to be oblivion because we're all going to die. And obviously, there's probably going to be a lot of torture before they die because, again, the Nazis had broken a lot of rules of warfare. So we've got the team. We've got it set up. They've got their mission. We know why it's important because they need to do something to affect the very successful U-boats in the Atlantic. So going into the actual mission, now, obviously, there's the book, there's the movie. I don't want to ruin anything, but I'll let you decide how much of Postmaster we cover or not. But the other thing that I found really intriguing was, and you touched on this earlier, is that parts of the government have to be ready to go to spin this because they can't just say, yay, we did this. We went into a neutral territory and we pull this off. No, they have to be ready to present some other form of the events for the rest of the world. Like you said, the British public, the Americans, but also the Axis as well, because I think it's after this, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's after this that Hitler's going to go, right, okay, any spies, anybody caught, immediate, you know, just if they're officers or whatever, I want them dead. Any enemy saboteurs or what have you, they are to just be eliminated.
Yeah, so Hitler did issue what became known as the Commando Order, which is a document which basically, and highly illegal, obviously. He got a team of lawyers together to try and make legal something which is patently illegal by all the rules of war. Mm-hmm. So they came up with this wording for his Commando Order, which basically says any of these special operators captured behind the lines, in uniform, out of uniform, armed or unarmed, trying to resist or not, or not trying to resist, shall be kept alive only for as long as the SS and Gestapo need them for interrogations, and then they shall be shot out of hand. Wow. And in fact, his commando order ends warning any officer who disobeys the commando order will be brought before the Nazi tribunal. So, you know, it's a very, very dark document. And part of the reason that Hitler authored that document was because for some reason, which is so hard to understand,
right,
he viewed these operations as like a personal affront against him. You study all the documents, like he really, really, for some reason, it really got his goat. I mean, I know there were assassination missions against high-ranking Nazi officials. I know that, you know, the SOE carried out those kind of operations, so perhaps he felt threatened, who knows. But yes, he very, very much took umbrage at these kind of operations and said, right, okay, any one of these guys who gets captured, or any of these females who get captured, they will be kept alive only for as long as we need them, and then they're dead, and they shall die in very nasty ways.
This podcast is sponsored by Monarch Money. Are you saving to reach your financial goals? Reaching those goals isn't just about getting more money, but by managing what you have. And the best way to manage your money? Monarch Money. Monarch Money is a new kind of finance app that's intuitive, powerful, ad-free, and takes the headaches out of budgeting. Try it free when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. Monarch puts all your accounts, investments, transactions, and finances at your fingertips. With a complete view of your finances, you'll gain insights on your spending and find new ways to save. Plus, Monarch lets you customize your dashboard, collaborate with your partner, set custom budgets and goals, and track your progress toward them. See why Mint users are turning to Monarch Money and loving it, and why the Wall Street Journal named Monarch Money the best budgeting app overall. Get a 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/podcast. That's monarchmoney.com/podcast for your free trial. monarchmoney.com/podcast.
Oh, and just real quick before we go on, earlier you were mentioning about Miss Gonzalez and giving the coin, and am I jealous? Yeah, a little bit, but the point I wanted to make was the gentlemen have weapons and they have a plan. She's got to go in and she's got to use her guile, her intelligence. Yes. Those aren't exactly as good as a gun if things turn bad. So again, that's a whole different level of bravery that I will never know. But she's dedicated to the cause.
Yeah, no, absolutely. So there are so many examples of young brave, immensely courageous, the bravest of the brave, these women who went, you know, deep behind enemy lines with nothing to protect them other than their wit, their humour, their guile, and you could argue their beauty as well.
Right.
You know, inconceivable what that must feel like and what that must take. So, yes, and let's be frank about it as mm-hmm. well. You know, there are worse things that the Gestapo can do to a woman to a woman than they can do to a man, and I don't want to have to elaborate.
Absolutely.
So they knew what they were taking on, and yet they still stepped into the fire. And, you know, I think, you know, Ms. Gonzalez does a great job of bringing that alive. You really get the sense from her that she's surviving on her wits, her elegance, her charm, her intelligence.
Yeah.
But her life is hanging by a thread. At so many times during the movie, you feel that. And I think that's part of the reason why, as you say, she kind of almost steals the show. Right. Because in a sense, the jeopardy that she's under is so much more real than the guys who are doing the operation.
Yeah, because I'm watching her and I'm like, why are you walking into this willingly? But again, there's a bigger cause. There's, you know, there's countries and people to save, and she wanted to do her part. She was just amazing. So what would you feel, what would you like to cover as far as Postmaster, or even if, you know, kind of behind the scenes, whatever you would like to share with us, obviously without ruining the experience for others, but whatever you would like to cover.
Yeah, I think one of the most key aspects of this mission was that this is what it turned around. You know, you mentioned the fact that SOE had to come up with a cover story.
Right.
They had to come up with a cover story that they were going to release to the world's media. And that cover story had to work not just in terms of our own in the American press, but in terms of the enemy's press.
Mm-hmm.
It had to have plausible deniability. We had to plausibly deny that we were responsible, we had to have plausible deniability, and so the political part of the SOE, which is called the political warfare executive, the propaganda wing,
mm-hmm.
wrote these stories even prior to the mission going out, basically right. saying the crews of the three enemy warships mutinied in San Fernando Po Harbor,
right.
because the conditions were so bad. Conditions were so bad in Fernando Po Harbor.
Right,
they weren't getting paid. You know, they were just, you know, unwilling to continue work is serving there, and so they mutinied, mm-hmm. cut their own anchor chains, sailed the ships out into international waters. At which point, a British warship just happened to be in the area,
right.
came across them and seized them as prizes of war, which of course you can do. If you encounter enemy warships on the high seas and you can seize them, they become your prizes of war. So that was the cover story put together.
Wow.
But what that meant was that, you know, when they went into to do the operation, they couldn't blow the warships up.
Right.
Because obviously you blew them up, all the evidence of your perfidy and it, you know, all the plausible deniability is blown out of the water.
Right.
You just can't do that. And in any case, actually, the, you know, the harbour was too shallow to affect a really effective sinking. Mm-hmm. And so operation became a cutout operation where they had to go in there, somehow sever the anchor chains and steal the vessels and get them underway and sail them out into international waters, at which point the cover story could go into operation.
Right.
So in terms of, you know, Mission Impossible, it would be hard enough to envision getting into the harbour unseen and undetected because it was very, very heavily defended.
Right.
And then, you know, assaulting the ship, dealing with the crew, and then blowing the ships up. That's hard enough. But to do all that, and then not to blow the ships up, but somehow start the engines and sail them out to international waters,
yes.
somehow keeping all the crew members under control, it just beggars belief. That was the operation that they were sent in to do. And in terms of a Mission Impossible, there is no other operation like it. It's, you know, the stakes were just beyond belief.
Absolutely. And I just have to say, during that part of the movie, I'm like almost screaming at the screen, can these ships move any faster? You know, trying to leave port. I'm like, come on, you're killing me here. That was the big payoff for all of that they had to go through. And obviously there's things that tripped them up. They had to change their plans a couple times. But like you said, these people are very developed or very talented at thinking outside the box, working off the cuff, kind of rolling with the punches. And that's what you need because they're doing it their own way.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, When you look at the lowest common denominator of what unites these individuals, it's being able to think the unthinkable. It's having that lateral mindset, right. And not just being able to think the unthinkable, but then to put it into action. So to think it and then to make it reality. Because if you can think of an unthinkable way to attack the enemy, you can bet your bottom dollar the enemy will never have thought of it. So they won't have defenses in place to defend against it.
Right.
And the other thing that they really, really needed on this operation, and again, it's the lowest common denominator of these kind of operatives, they needed the ability to disobey orders when they had to.
Right.
So there's a moment in the movie where they are basically ordered to stand down the operation by one of these senior military figures who believed it was unconscionable that British soldiers should be off doing something as piratical as this.
Right.
And S. March Phillips basically says he uses an expletive and basically pretends that he's lost his radio signal and can't hear the order.
Right.
That was exactly what was needed on the ground. Because, of course, yes, Churchill backed the mission, but he couldn't always be there to give them top cover. He was a very busy guy at the time. And there were moments, several moments in the story, both in the movie and in real life, where their detractors try to stop the operation going ahead, mm-hmm. and they have to find another way and make one. I mean, there's one story in the book, absolutely true, where they sailed the Maid Honor, their cue ship, to actually Lagos, the port in Nigeria, which was British territory at the time.
Right.
And they're to pick up a load of sailors and soldiers to boost their numbers, and the British military commander refuses to provide any.
Yeah.
Because he just is one of these naysayers who believes this shouldn't be happening. So what do they do? And it's delicious, it's brilliant. They say they go to the governor of Nigeria and explain the situation. They decide that they will recruit members of the British administration in Nigeria. So you're talking like, you know, teachers and surveyors and anybody with a smidging of First World War experience, whatever it might be.
Right.
And one of the guys is in his 50s, and they all step forward as volunteers.
Wow.
You know, this is real dad's army stuff.
Right, exactly.
And they've got 48 hours to train them at sea in this unbelievably difficult cutout operation. And that's what I'm saying. That is the lateral thinking, doing the unexpected. And when people try and get in your way and stop you, you just find a way around them.
Yeah. The masters of workaround, if you will. But yeah. And please don't take this the wrong way, but I always thought the British people would be great pirates. So I'm not surprised. But no, I love the British people. I'm just joking. So I want people to know, as far as the book is concerned, so I've got the book, but I also got the audiobook because I do a lot of walking with my dog. And I finished Postmaster, and then I look down at my phone and I'm like, this audiobook still has 7 hours to go. So obviously you continue the story of some of these people. You continue the story of other operations. And I have to say that the Danes and the others really did step up. And even though Postmaster is incredible, there's a lot of other incredible events, operations that they undertake. And you're right, it might just be a pinprick, but if you put enough of them together, it starts to tell and it affects the enemy overall.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, man, these guys, did they step forward and did they do the most incredible things? I mean, you know, bear in mind, pretty much none of them survived the war.
Right.
And Anders Lassen, you know, he is, there are three statues at the SAS base in the UK. There's David Stirling, the founder of the SAS. Mm-hmm. There's Blair Paddy Maine, who went on to lead the SAS through the war.
Right.
And there's Anders Lassen.
Wow.
The only member of the British SAS ever to win the Victoria Cross, which is our highest valor decoration. And Lassen and his band of warriors go on to achieve the most extraordinary operations throughout the rest of the book. And so, you know, one of the ideas behind, you know, making the movie on Postmaster was also that you can bring those same individuals, those same characters back for movie sequels. And there's, you know, there are half a dozen further missions in the book, which just make for such amazing, amazing movies. I mean, I don't know if you've got to the point yet of where Lassen and a few crazy warriors liberate Salonika, the second big city in Greece from the Nazis, using two fire engines. And bluff. It is the most, it's just the most incredible story. And there are so many like that.
Yeah.
And so throughout the war, they keep that spirit going, that spirit of, you know, daring do, but lateral thinking the unexpected, bluff, deception, all the things that, you know, these units were set up to do at this time, which hadn't really been done before.
Right.
And so that's why, you know, when you get to the end of the Postmaster, you're probably a fifth of the way through the book. That's all.
Yeah, exactly. And you made me think of something just now. Not only does this give, not only does this hurt your enemy, you know, these operations, but it also gives the British people heart. It gives them hope. And like you said, it's good for the Americans as well. So they're, because they're not thinking, oh, you know, Britain's going to fall any day now. Why should we bother? So obviously there was a lot riding on this. And in my own personal opinion, and I'm sure you've heard this before, and I won't give anything away because I want people to read the book, the operation on Crete. Oh my goodness. If that's not...
You're talking about the Heraklion operation?
Yes. If that's not the next movie, I'm going to protest.
You know,
yeah.
Let me tell you something, right? Let me tell you something. You're going to love this. Okay. So
right.
I know, 8 months ago, I get invited to go on set, and they're filming on HMS Belfast in London, because HMS Belfast is World War II ship moored in London, right? You'll recognize some of the scenes from the movie. And so I go there, and I meet Henry Cavill, who's a true gentleman. Mm-hmm. What a nice guy. And I met Alan Richardson, and I'm 5'6".
Right.
So Alan Richardson is twice as big as me, at least, right? So I'm staring up at him going... So tell me, hey, what's it been like, you know, playing Anders Lassen and trying to master a Danish accent?
Right.
We're having a laugh. And then he said to me, you know, I'll never forget this. He said, do you know what I'm really looking forward to? He said, I just want to play Lassen in the raid on Heraklion.
Yes.
When he's running around that airbase,
yes,
yelling out all those orders in German and convincing the enemy he's actually a German officer, where actually he's the person they're blowing up all their war guns. He said, I've got to play that God I'm seeing.
I know. I was like the guts on this guy when I'm reading that part of the book, and he goes back. You don't go back. He went back.
He went back three times. Oh, there's another warplane over there. Let's go back in. And he's got the British guy with him, and the British guy's going, what? Again? Yes, we are going. Now we go. Lassen was brilliant. He was an absolute.
Yeah.
You know, he's a legend amongst the men he led. And actually, being serious for a moment, yes, one of the things about Lassen, you know, one should never forget is that, you know, the men under his command, they adored him.
Right.
They revered him.
Yeah.
And when, you know, and when other commanders, stuffy, you know, mainstream British officers came and tried to berate them for their somewhat unsoldierly looking appearance, because they did tend to dress as they saw fit,
sure,
in the uniform they fit, because they felt that they should wear what they most felt comfortable soldiering in. Lassen would jump to their defense in the most fantastic way. There's a scene later in the book, you'll love it, where exactly that happens, and Lassen absolutely takes the officer in question to the cleaners. So yeah, he was, you know, revered by those he commanded. And part of the reason was because he never expected anyone to do what he would not do himself.
Right.
He led front always. He dies on operations right at the end of the war, charging down a machine gun there single-handedly, leading his men. So, you know, that kind of, you know, it would be very difficult not to be brave in the company of such an individual.
Absolutely. And I've been studying World War II long enough to know at the end of the day, it all comes down to leadership. It comes down to example. It comes down to caring for your men. If you take care of your people, they will take care of you. And just that teamwork mentality, we could certainly use a lot more of that. And what was their... And I don't want to give anything away to the readers, but the whole bow and arrow thing, there's more of that in the book where he has to, I think, either ask permission or something like that. But he does get a chance to use his bow and arrow.
Lassen petitions the British War Office. It's one of the first things he does,
right,
when he's been recruited to SOE. He petitions the British War Office explaining why the bow and arrow is the perfect weapon in World War II. It's a silent killing weapon.
Yes,
it's true.
Yes.
It never runs out of bullets. You can always make more bows and arrows from, you know, stuff you carve from a tree. He's got all these reasons why it's a perfect weapon for World War II, especially for the SOE. So he petitions the War Office for it to be used in SOE operations. And they give him permission to test out bows and arrows in Dorset. And then they come back with the decision that the bow and arrow is too inhumane.
Right.
To be used in World War II. I mean, go figure. The flamethrower's okay.
Right.
You know, but not the bow and arrow. So Lassen takes no notice of that at all, of course. He carries on as before. as you would expect.
I'm trying to picture someone argue the point. No, I'd rather be killed the traditional way in war. Thank you. Like if that actually mattered. Okay, so I just want everybody to know that the movie was great. It was a lot of fun. Lots of great tense moments. The gentleman, I'm sorry, I can't remember his name, but the gentleman that played the lead German.
Very good.
I was scared of him. If I met him today, yeah, I would be afraid of him right now. But
yeah, very good.
The movie is fantastic, obviously, if I can say this, and I hope Guy Ritchie doesn't get mad at me. The book was better because it had so much more in it, but I really enjoyed the book very much. And if we could be just lighthearted for a moment, I know you're a busy man, but you've been on the show, I think this is your third time. After the first time that you left, and I was thinking about it, and I can't remember if I said anything to you, but I'm like, you know, one of these days, someone's going to take one of his books and they're going to make a film into it. And I just hope he calls me and just, Ray, this is happening. I'm going to bring you, you can drive my car, you can carry my bags, whatever. So I'm a little disappointed. I mean, but again, I didn't really say anything to you. I'm not blaming you.
You should have said something. I'd have given you a call, seriously. But, you know, how was I to know?
You're right. I should have.
Next time.
Okay, see, that's all. Like, you don't even have to mean it. I just appreciate you saying it. So next time.
Where are you based in the States? Just so I know geographically when to call you.
Right, Virginia, Central Virginia.
Virginia, you're perfect.
Yeah.
Perfect, man.
Yeah.
I mean, let's do it.
Okay. Now, I cannot drive on the left-hand side of the road, but other than that, I would be a great driver. Okay. I just want you to know.
No. Yeah. Listen. Next time there's a movie released in the States, you are booked, my friend.
Thank you. I have to go buy pants. Anyway, that's a whole nother story. You don't want to hear about that. So everybody needs to check out the movie and also the book, The Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare, How Churchill's Secret Warriors Set Europe Ablaze and Gave Birth to the Modern Black Ops. Mr. Lewis, thank you very much for your time. Thank you for this movie and the book. And obviously, I'm jealous of your existence. If I could trade places with you, I would.
Well, look, it's always a pleasure to be on your show. Let's do another one soon. Let's do another one when there's a next movie coming out. And it may be the sequel to Ministry of Ungentlemanly Warfare. It may be another one, but I'll be back. Yeah.
Perfect. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It's lunchtime at Tim Hortons, and we're serving up a special deal just for you. Our new $5.99 lunch deal includes your choice of any lunch sandwich and a side of crunchy kettle chips. Because what's lunch without a little crunch? And the sandwich choice is all yours, like a ham and Swiss, Chipotle chicken wrap, BLT, and more, made to order just the way you like it. Tim Hortons' new lunch deal. Simple, delicious, and just $5.99. Now that's a good deal. Only at your neighborhood Tim's. U.S. only. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.